Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And a little bit later in the show, we are going to be discussing the opioid crisis in America and some of the moves that Donald Trump has made in the past couple days around that, as well as Congress. We're going to talk about the whole dust up between April Ryan and Sean Spicer, and of course, the ongoing efforts by the United States Senate to pin something on Russia as it regards colluding with Trump in the U.S. election. But before we can move on, in the past couple weeks or so, we've tried to draw our attention to the clear, your attention, I should say, to the clear escalation in military force taking place across the Middle East by the United States. That also is notably linked with the far more bellicose attitude towards North Korea and a quiet but determined escalation of special forces across a wide swath of the African continent. In a very notable policy shift yesterday, this process continued to deepen. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson lifted all human rights conditions on the sale of arms to Bahrain. The sale of almost $3 billion worth of F-16 jets that had been blocked was the biggest arms sale that these restrictions were holding up that's now expected to move forward. The restrictions had been put in place by the Obama administration after widespread condemnation about the United States' total lack of action regarding the brutal crackdown on mass protests in Bahrain by the absolute monarchy run by the Al Khalifa family. In 2011, as the Arab Spring swept the region, Bahrain's people also rose up, along with people in Egypt and Tunisia, among others. Huge protests arose against the monarchs whose regime, like pretty much all the other absolute monarchies in the region, was brutal, intolerant, and loved to torture people. The Bahraini monarchy is a close friend of the United States, and the country hosts the U.S. Fifth Fleet. And also, a large number of the people in the country are Shia and not Sunni, so regional powers like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, as well as the United States, saw the protest as dangerous, despite even the king's own commission stating that the protests were not instigated by Iran. The feeling from regional powers in the U.S. was that the fall of the monarchy was dangerous because any new government may want to gasp, have relations with Iran. So the U.S. stood by as the king and his minions brutally cracked down on the protest, a huge double standard, as many noted, since America enthusiastically supports protest movements against governments it doesn't like all the time under the guise of human rights. Bahrain, with the help of the armies of Saudi Arabia and UAE, crushed the protest movement and the encampment that was at the Pearl Roundabout, and since then have engaged in a long-running campaign of terror against their opponents. Human rights groups have noted the behavior from the monarchy, noting that the founder of one of the few independent newspapers was beaten to death in custody, that journalists have been tortured, protesters shot and killed, and that literally hundreds have been convicted and jailed in show trials simply for expressing opposition to the regime. And 13, in fact, of the most prominent opposition leaders were tried and given lengthy sentences by military tribunals. Even the leader of the main licensed opposition party is now being charged for insulting the interior minister. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee will now have some review here, but will probably do nothing to stop these arms sales. Committee Chair Senator Bob Corker has already signaled his approval. And this is also seen as a sign that the U.S. will move forward aggressively with arms sales to others in the region who also happen to be not that great on human rights, in particular Saudi Arabia, to help them scale up their war in Yemen. Mr. Tillerson has already stated he wants to sell the Saudis 16,000 guided munitions kits, the better to bomb Yemen with. Clearly, the administration's tilt towards confrontation with Iran is now on full force. Strengthening the absolute monarchies in the region and cozying up to the al-Sisi government in Egypt is a key sign of this. The creation of an anti-Iran bloc dates back to a dream of the Bush administration and is a pet project of the neocons, and which is certainly a key element to all of this, because most of the people who are known to aggressively support policies like the ones we just discussed actually supported Hillary Clinton in the election, and in fact some of them raised money for her on the basis that she would do things like this. So while Trump and his team certainly deserve condemnation, it's worth noting that neither major party candidate in this election would have done anything much differently. The general drift of U.S. policy was moving back towards deepening wars and conflicts around the globe. So strap in, because we're headed even further down the conflict rabbit hole. Well, we told you yesterday the controversy over the HB2 bill, the so-called bathroom bill in North Carolina, was taking a number of strange turns, and last night, and then I guess today, took another. After one deal broke down between the Republicans and the legislature and the governor, another one was reached late last night between Roy Cooper, he's a Democrat, the governor, and the Republican leaders of the state legislature to repeal HB2, that is. However, that compromise was denounced by most LGBT groups, and they told people to vote against it. Despite that, the law ended up passing. So to briefly recapitulate everything that took place here. Charlotte, North Carolina, in early 2016 passed a law that prohibited discrimination on the basis of gender identity. Conservatives erupted in anger as they thought this would somehow allow men to use women's restrooms. They responded in the state legislature by passing HB2 that specifically required in government buildings people use the bathroom corresponding to the gender assigned to them on their birth certificate, not their current gender identity. It also, interestingly enough, banned localities from passing non-discrimination ordinances, period, raising the minimum wage, or regulating child labor. This caused a reverse uproar. As people pointed out, it was clearly discriminatory against the transgendered population and also absurdly took aim at many important workers' rights. Many large companies pulled out of or stopped expansions in North Carolina as a result. And earlier this week, the AP estimated the economic impact was so huge that over the next 12 years, it could cost the state $3.7 billion. This, of course, has been something that made some Republicans regret that the law was ever passed in the first place and to try to find some way to do a climb down and repeal it. Democrats won the governor's mansion last fall, more or less, because people want to see HB2 repealed in the state. Several repeal attempts, however, had failed because Republicans are determined to prevent any locality in the state from passing a non-discrimination ordinance. The repeal bill contains a moratorium on localities enacting anti-discrimination ordinances until 2020, and explicitly gives the legislature, I guess, the right to deal with bathroom issues. So opponents of HB2 urge the compromise to be rejected. And given that the bill clearly still creates room for discrimination, it's unclear whether or not this would be enough to satisfy groups like the NAACP, which gave North Carolina till the end of the week to repeal the bill to be considered for NCAA championship events, which, as you might imagine, it's a big moneymaker. So it seems that, yet again, the desire of North Carolina Republicans to play to the hard right whims of billionaire Art Pope's political network could doom North Carolina to significant economic hardship. Hopefully other states will note all this rigmarole and refuse to sacrifice jobs and investment simply to be able to marginalize transgendered people. Well, the state of Washington seems to be looking to set a record here as the state that's suing Donald Trump the most. Yesterday, the city of Seattle sued the Trump administration over its threat to defund sanctuary cities. They state that the threat in and of itself, or the executive order that was around it, is unconstitutional. This is part of a longer running feud between the Trump administration and cities over this. In a meeting this week between police chiefs and mayors and the Department of Homeland Security head John Kelly, Kelly got an earful from local officials who pointed out they have no actual legal obligation to deal with immigration, which is a federal concern, and thus not doing it under a sanctuary policy actually doesn't put them in violation of any laws. They also pointed out that reducing funding could paradoxically increase crime, contrary to what Trump administration officials claim to want, due to decreased resources and lack of assistance from undocumented people in reporting things deemed as quote-unquote crimes. Kelly himself noted at the meeting they don't even have a definition of what a sanctuary city is. Well, seems tough to punish them if you don't know what they are, which certainly reveals that the whole pledge was more of a campaign rhetoric type thing than policy the whole time. The administration is just trying to do everything possible to inject a sense of fear and confusion in immigrant populations and to try to scare away citizens and undocumented immigrants for advocating on behalf of immigrant rights. And it's clearly part of a broader push in the Trump administration to move the country into a different sort of footing here, sort of a nationalistic footing with strong racial overtones and free reign for corporations to exploit all natural and human resources with very little government interference. This requires not only that the undocumented be pushed far into the shadows, but the creation of an immigration policy that criminalizes and demonizes the whole idea, really, of immigrants coming to the country, portraying it as some sort of dangerous invasion that must be controlled or checked or whatever. So whether or not the Trump administration actually follows through with its threats or just on just about every major American city is yet to be seen. But just like the travel ban, expect the courts to have their say as well. And those are today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here as we switch gears a little bit by Professor Jason Johnson. He's professor of political science and communications at Morgan State University in Baltimore and also the political editor at The Root. Jason, thank you so much for joining the show.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here, Eugene. Anything for our mutual friend. So happy to be on the show, and we'll come back anytime.
Awesome. Well, that is fantastic. And you made a bit of news yesterday on MSNBC, got into a little kerfluffle there with Matt Schlapp from the American Conservative Union over Sean Spicer's interaction with, if you want to call it that, April Ryan, who's a really well-known black journalist, in the hearing yesterday, in the White House press briefing yesterday. The issue, as for people who don't know there, is Sean Spicer and April Ryan got into it. He was telling her to stop shaking her head in response to some of his comments that, you know, she viewed to not be as fully forthcoming. Big back and forth. A lot of people were raising this issue as a sign of racism coming out of the Trump administration. So let me start with just by asking you this, Jason. I think that one of the things that's interesting about this sort of whole controversy and maybe the whole Trump administration is that despite the fact that we could probably sit here and point to like 30 to 50 different things that Trump administration people have done or proposed, there's still not sort of like a clear field in the reporting that really they are trying to promote, you know, sort of a racist, ethno-nationalist vision for what America should be.
Well, yeah, that's what they're doing. I don't think a lot of the press wants to acknowledge it. I think it's because in a lot of ways, like, we don't have real discussions in America about what racism is, right? We don't really talk about it. They talk about this person's racist, that person's racist. And all too often, you have white people making the determination as to whether something's racist or not. And you really can't do that. Racism is not in the intent. Racism is in the recipient. So I think there's failure on the part of a lot of the press to cover these issues in a substantive way. But even worse, when we want to have sort of more meaningful discussions, no one is there to really referee it one way or another. So that's how we get into these arguments. That's how we get into these fights. That's how Sean Spicer becomes a topic of discussion, as opposed to people just turning around and saying in general, oh, yeah, this guy is a racist, this guy is an idiot, and we shouldn't be listening to what he has to say.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, especially for a lot of black people who I think you're very right, it's especially on cable news, you know, it's so – I think what frustrates a lot of people is that there's even like a sort of a point-counterpoint piece here. Like if someone brought me on MSNBC to talk about fracking or whatever, and I've worked for Exxon for the past 20 years, I mean, one, they probably wouldn't bring me on. But two, like that would be a relevant point that would be considered a conflict of interest if I was arguing in favor of fracking. But when it comes to racism, it's sort of like the assumption is, you know, there's two sides to this. You know what I mean? And the fact that there is sort of a point counterpoint and not kind of like a disclaimer the way we do with corporate donations or jobs or whatever, I think is one of the more frustrating things.
Well, yeah, but see, and the problem is we've been seeing this with these and a lot of other issues since we've gotten to the Trump era, right? Suddenly we're having discussions about things that we used to think were pretty standard. So, for example, you know, how are we having a conversation about Milo Yiannopoulos? The guy's a pedophile and a racist. But we literally had to have conversations on television for 48 hours about what defines pedophilia, right? Because the guy gets on the radio and says, yeah, it's okay for men to have sex with younger boys. So what Trump has done overall in our society is lowered the standards of conversation and forced us to have these asinine discussions of things that heretofore no one would ever think you have to talk about. And so race is just a microcosm of that. And I'll also say this. It is just being raw and real and about the whole damn thing. The truth of the matter is white men in positions of power don't like being told no. White men in positions of power don't like being told no by anybody, and definitely not people of color. So when I'm on the air with Matt Schlapp, and he says this isn't racist, and I'm like, that's not how this works. That's not how any of this works. You can't tell me what is or is not racist because you don't experience it. And he literally got physically in my face. He was so angry that he had been told no, that his hand had been slapped away. And that's the kind of attitude and banality and aggression that has been released by the president that we have right now.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good point. And I think sort of the power of racism often gets lost in this point. But the fact that you raised the issue of Milo, I think, is so huge is, you know, the outrageous thing that got him taken down, you know, sort of removed from the political sphere here in a big way was when the pedophilia pieces came out. And certainly that was not a good look. So I'm not mad that it happened that way. But it was like when he was just saying terrible things about, you know, black people and Latino immigrants or whatever, you know, people didn't really want to touch it. And I always wonder, like, if in the media there's sort of like the Michael Jordan, you know, Republicans buy shoes too kind of piece, where even though they may know what's going on, it's like, yeah, but if we put that out there, are people going to read it?
Well, you know, I think it's that, but I also think it's just it's cowardice and fascination, right? Because at the end of the day, we don't have to have discussions about those things that we agree on as a society are wrong. We don't have to debate pedophilia. We don't have to debate rape. We don't have to debate murder. But we end up debating racism because no one wants to actually talk about what racism is or what it does. And this is a key thing, Eugene, and I think, you know, everybody in the audience, I want them to understand this. Personally and politically, I don't care if somebody's racist or not. I don't care if Donald Trump was a racist. I don't care if Matt Schlapp was a racist. I think Matt Schlapp was a racist. So is Sean Spicer. So is Donald Trump. But here's the thing. There's nothing wrong legally with being a racist. We're in America. You can have whatever beliefs you want. The problem is when your racism impacts how you do the job. You can be the most bigoted cop in the world, but if you adjudicate fairly in the streets, I don't care. But when your bigotry leads you to shooting black people for, you know, walking down the street with a can of soda and you claim it's a gun, that's where racism becomes a problem. So we waste time on discussing what racism is. We don't talk enough about what the impact of racism is. That's how you can have these dumb conversations like, you don't know what's wrong. I don't care what's in his heart. I see what he does.
No, I think that's a great point. Let me shift to frame two a little bit here, too, to April Ryan, who I think has emerged as, like, you know, a big media figure now just because she's been very aggressive, you know, and you know, asking questions of the Trump administration, like any good journalist certainly would do, you would think. But, you know, the fact that she also has represented, and this almost never gets mentioned, the America's Urban Radio Network. So she's doing a lot of reporting for a bunch of black-oriented radio stations around the country. I mean, that seems like it's interesting, too, as well, because there's been so much of a conversation about black media, I think, over the past decade and the decline of black media and how to revive it and whether or not places like BET are doing a disservice by reducing their news content. I mean, it seems like there's also a subsidiary conversation to be had here about April Ryan representing black outlets as a, you know, prominent black journalist in a sphere where I think we'd seen sort of less of that, or to where we've seen the conversation, it's been more about diversity in newsrooms as opposed to black media.
Well, I got to tell you, as somebody who teaches undergraduates and graduates in a journalism department, our definition of news is so dated. I don't think the conversation is about black media outlets anymore. I think the conversation is about what actually constitutes news and what constitutes opinion. Right? Because the issue is there are plenty of black reporters out there. There's hundreds of black newspapers across America. There still are. They're online. They're in print. You've got Ebony. You've got Essence. You've got TheRoot.com. We're on the Politics Editor. There is a lot of news primarily written by, driven by, and edited by black people out there. The problem is that in the larger mainstream news outlets, the cable networks that people pay attention to, you don't have black people or people of color or women in editorial positions, so you don't get a diversity of opinion. The conversation that I had yesterday with Matt Schlapp only happened because of certain people at networks who have a commitment to saying, hey, maybe we should have more than the same five black people ask these questions. That conversation only happens because someone recognizes that there's multiple roles, that we don't have to fill in the blank. Well, we've got this kind of black guy, we've got this kind of black guy, and the truth of the matter is that's the problem. So it's not about a lack of black media. It's about in the supposedly neutral spaces of political discussion, you don't have enough diversity of voice.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I always think about that when I see Mark Lamont Hill on CNN. I love what he does, but I'm just like, man, you know, of all the sort of black commentators that are out there that I think really embody a lot of sort of like the Black Lives Matter activism that's happening on the street, the fact that like, he's kind of the one person I can point to that I think, you know, people like myself who are out there would say, like, yeah, these are a lot of the views we're talking about. That's consistently on cable news. And it just seems so crazy because obviously millions of people are supporting, you know, what the movement for Black Lives is saying. And you'd think that would be something that you'd want to get on there much more just purely to reflect what's happening. But it doesn't happen. So that's an interesting point, I think.
Well, and also it's a matter of, look, everybody's got their own taste. You know, you've got Mark, you've got Bakari, you've got Angela Rye, you've got Joy. There are a number of African Americans who are on television every day speaking. You've got Stephen A. Smith. I mean, you've got black people who are on TV. But the question, the issue that we're facing, if we want to talk about news in general, is who has the ability to to green light somebody having a show? Who has the ability to bring people back? That's what's important. Part of what was compelling also about what happened yesterday is, you know, Matt literally got in my face, you know, and he's going to be invited back somewhere. And that is something that we have to think about, that he is going to be invited back somewhere to have a discussion when we all know very well that as an African-American male, had I gotten physically aggressive and gotten within an inch of someone's face on any topic, up to and including whether or not Colin Kaepernick should be getting another job, you know, I would be considered a danger and a menace. And that's the sort of media discussion that we also need to have, that we have to recognize that the standards by which different people are held aren't the same. Look, Sean Spicer is a jerk to a lot of people. Sean Spicer says rude things to a lot of people. So it ain't like him being rude isn't unique. But telling a black woman, don't shake your head at me, is fundamentally different than just saying shut up. Because he told a lot of people to shut up, but he doesn't tell them how to control their body.
And I think that's a great place to leave it. And you can check out more from Jason on Twitter at Dr. Jason Johnson, at Dr. Jason Johnson. And also, of course, TheRoot.com doing a lot of great work that you should follow as well. We are going to take a break with that on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking a little bit about some of the ripple effects and actual things that were discussed coming out of the Senate intelligence hearing, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, I should say, regarding, I guess, whatever you want to call it, the alleged Russian interference in the U.S. elections. I don't even know, it's gotten so broad-based here. But either way, we are very happy to be joined by the journalist Rania Kolick to continue this conversation. Rania, thank you so much for joining the show.
Hi.
So this morning was the first Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on Russia. It was basically focused today, well, there's much more coming apparently, on RT and Sputnik and the role that they have played in, I guess, destroying America, more or less seemed that what the content was summing it up. So here you are on Sputnik already. So I don't know, maybe that discredits you in some eyes. But, you know, the thing to me that was very ridiculous is that, you know, the things that they highlight that they're saying, well, this shows that they're trying to undermine America are like reports on Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, climate change, nuclear weapons. I mean, issues of concern to all people, things being discussed in all media, and certainly things that are traditionally undercovered in American media. And I mean, it just seems crazy to me that they would point to these things as some sort of issue when these are actual newsworthy problems that exist in America.
Totally. And on top of that, it's so stupid. I mean, I know that's not the most sophisticated way to put it, but it's just stupid. The idea that RT and Sputnik are like controlling American brains or something is just dumb. I mean, compared to the rest of the media, it's not like, you know, it's not like RT has all this control over the narrative. It's just ridiculous. But yeah, it's also the topics. This is something they've been saying for a while. I mean, even as far back as when they first had released that intelligence report, and I put intelligence in big quotes, saying that, you know, that Russia undermined American democracy because RT reported on fracking. I mean, it's really stupid. And it starts to, because the Democrats are kind of the ones leading the charge on this. I've started to feel like this is like the Democratic version of like Benghazi or something, except Benghazi actually had like at least some part of it was like, you know, there was something there. But whereas this is just, you know, built on top of lies and BS and no actual evidence. And so now like Democrats have taken the place of like the Glenn Becks of the world. It's so weird.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. And I'm glad you raised that point about the narrative, too, because, and ironically enough, one of the things that was released in either the DNC leaks, the Podesta leaks, one of them, was how their whole campaign, the Hillary campaign, was like, oh, you know what we got to do? We got to elevate Trump. We got to do whatever we can to elevate Trump and to elevate Cruz because we can definitely beat them. And you think about it, and this was something that many Bernie Sanders supporters were complaining about and certainly supporters of third parties the whole election long. I mean, all the time that, you know, the mainstream media spent on television covering like Trump podiums and every new Trump outrage and every single Trump tweet and this, that, and the third. Like, how you could say that somehow, you know, RT or whatever was responsible more for the framing of the election and what people thought and how they did it. It just seems a little, seems out of whack. And also, on top of that, I mean, look, since 1993, right-wing news outlets have been creating random hit pieces against Hillary Clinton that are based on complete lies and falsification. Russia could exist. I mean, it just seems like to act like, oh, this never would have happened without Russia, it just ignores all that context.
Yeah, totally. It's also, if you watched any of RT's coverage of the election, it was not pro-Trump. I mean, that's just wrong to say. It wasn't. It was very much, you know, very antagonistic towards Trump and Hillary Clinton. Definitely wasn't pro-Trump. And so that's just, to even frame it that way is completely inaccurate. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned all of these, you know, all of the talk radio and right-wing radio that's been like building this case against Hillary forever. And yeah, that all of that is just completely erased. And I think a big part of this obsession with Russia, I think it's twofold. Part of it is because, you know, American foreign policy has sort of been headed in this direction with this kind of, you know, resurgence of the Cold War, if you will, between the U.S. and Russia. But the second part of that is also just the fact that Democrats seem completely incapable, or I guess more like the establishment seems completely incapable of any introspection on why they lost the election. And they're just obsessed with blaming, you know, someone from the outside. They're obsessed with blaming anybody but themselves. And so they have, you know, they've sort of, they're holding on to this Russia thing and they're trying to make it work because, you know, the alternative to that is to actually, you know, consider, hey, why did we lose the country to Donald Trump? And nobody wants to consider that. And so I think that there's like a twofold thing going on there. And what's been really like really stunning throughout all this is that it's just so hysterical. The anti-Russia stuff is so hysterical, but it's also being led by liberals and even progressives are buying into it. And some people on the left are buying into it, and it's just weird. And it's like, you can't even have like a rational discussion about it.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm glad you raised that because to me, one of the more interesting subsidiary issues about all of this, and I think, you know, you referenced the random intelligence report on RT that was ripping them for covering a bunch of progressive issues. You know, you had the Proper Not piece when that first came out that was smearing basically every progressive website that doesn't uncritically support the Democratic Party all of a sudden was Russian propaganda. That really sort of a side piece here that I think should make people think about the motivations of a lot of this is that it's delegitimizing progressive politics by essentially adding this like loyalty litmus test that if you, you know, push too hard, all of a sudden you're a Russian agent. And if you don't, you know, if you criticize Democrats in the course of it, all of a sudden you must be a Russian agent. And it seems like to me that is sort of it's a subsidiary issue, but it's also a pretty poisonous issue in the way that it sort of sets up the debate.
Totally. I mean, you've got people being called Russian agents left and right. And it's also, like you said, it undermines progressive politics. It also, I mean, look what's happening right now. You've got the Republicans in charge of everything, and they're the worst of the Republicans in charge of everything. And they're trying to push through these awful, awful policy changes. You know, they want to like gut all these important things like the EPA, and you know, they miserably failed at trying to you know, undo Obamacare and put in place something way, way worse. And the only reason they failed, it's not even because Democrats really pushed back effectively. They failed because they're just completely inept, you know. Meanwhile, Democrats are, you know, the only opposition that has any power, if you can even call it that. And what are they spending their time doing? They're not spending their time really fighting Trump in an effective way at all. They're spending their time obsessing over Russia. And that's why if you look at, you know, and I hate to get all like, you know, obsessed with polling and like elections and stuff, but that's why if you look at polling right now, Democrats are, the party itself is less popular than Donald Trump is. I mean, you have to be really bad and really like, and people and really disconnected from the country for you to be more disliked than Donald Trump right now. It's really just stunning. And that's what's happening at the moment is it's like undermining talking about anything else. Like there's so many issues we should be talking about right now. And instead, the, you know, every time I look up at a TV screen with a cable news outlet on it, it's something like breaking new, you know, Russia, you know, Putin is behind this now. And it's just, it's so insane. And it's, I mean, you just can't have a conversation about anything. Everything's Russia, Russia, Russia all the time. And, you know, I'm going to tell you right now, like the country doesn't care about foreign policy. As someone who covers foreign policy, that's something I know well. The country does not care about foreign policy. So talking about Russia might win you points in the establishment press, but at the end of the day, it's not going to make you more popular among voters or Americans or make them feel like you're doing anything even remotely important for them.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. I mean, of course, you know, this hearing was like the top line issue on every single media outlet, although also right now in Capitol Hill, I think as we speak, there's a hearing on community policing and criminal justice. There's like famous people who are testifying, obviously a huge, very important issue.
But Eugene, were there any Russians there?
Well, Anquan Boldin, the NFL player, is testifying right now. I hope he just tries to make, just says Russia five times, like with no connection to anything else. And then everyone will tune to it and be like, oh my God, Anquan Boldin's talking about Russia. You know, and who even knows what he may have to say. But raising the foreign policy issue, I think one thing that this reveals in an interesting way is, you know, people like myself, people like yourself and the work that, you know, we've done over the years have consistently pointed out the role that the U.S. plays in meddling in other countries' elections and, you know, political processes. And people in other countries always very upset about this. Americans always say, oh, we're just promoting democracy. We're only doing good things. And we're spending all this money to just do good things. You know, that's what we do overseas. Other people are angry. But now, and I mean, again, I don't want to give too much credence to it, but now I think it's just interesting to see the whole U.S. media political establishment completely up in arms that perhaps somehow another country would decide to try to influence America. Not that they weren't already doing it, but I think it's just very interesting to see how this is the biggest outrage in the history of all outrages. But then when you have much more verifiable evidence of U.S. meddling in different elections and things like that, there's no big upcry or big uproar or even a conversation about why this might upset people in other countries.
Yeah, I mean, it's especially stunning about the Russia issue because the U.S. has literally meddled in every single Russian election since the fall of the Soviet
Union.
They
rigged the election in 1996 to keep the communists from winning. They rigged the election.
And they installed an extremely unpopular guy, Boris Yeltsin. And when he was done serving, he appointed Putin to like sort of be his, you know, the next person to be in charge. So all this antagonism and hatred around Putin is hilarious because the U.S. was fine with him until like 2003 when he didn't support the Iraq War.
Right. And he wasn't as compliant as necessary.
Exactly. And so it's all of that gets lost in the mix. I mean, it's shocking that Russia hasn't meddled. Like, it's shocking that Russia hasn't done more to get back at the U.S., to be honest. Beyond that, you know, there's that aspect of it, the complete hypocrisy, because obviously the U.S. has meddled in like so many countries around the world.
Please talk about Israel and the role they play in U.S. elections. I don't know if that's where you were going, but please do.
Yeah, no, of course. It's not just Israel. It's like, look at these countries that actually do play a role in undermining American democracy. Israel is probably the most blatant example because you have this massive Israel lobby that makes it impossible to do anything about the Israel-Palestine issue that doesn't help Israel steal more Palestinian land. And I mean, they literally push people out of office. They bully the hell out of people. It's the Israel lobby is so effective at controlling anything that has to do with Israel policy in the U.S. And it's not just the Israel lobby. Look at the Gulf monarchies and their lobbies. I mean, the Saudis, for example, look at Saudi Arabia's undermining of American democracy. The kinds of policies that petrodollars push that actually make Americans less safe because it empowers extremist groups in the Middle East. I mean, that's literally what Saudi Arabia and its pals in the Middle East push for U.S. policy to do. And beyond that, I mean, it's you know, you can talk about not just even countries, but entire industries that, you know, undermine American democracy. Like, why aren't we talking about these things? They actually have evidence to back that up. Whereas with the Russia situation, and you know what? Like, I don't have a hard time believing that a country might have like meddled in U.S. elections because the U.S. does it all the time and countries do it to each other all the time. But I have also not seen a shred of evidence, not one shred of evidence to prove this narrative that's been like reported as fact that like Russia undermined American democracy by hacking into John Podesta's emails and then releasing them to WikiLeaks. It's such a stupid narrative, and it feels like everyone's gone crazy and lost their minds in Washington. It really, really, really does.
No, I certainly agree with you there. There was that New York Times article. There was a great article, I think, from 2014, that one of those articles that flew under the radar, but it was all about like the Brookings Institution and all these think tanks and how they're taking all this money. Norway was actually the country that got wrapped, but all this money from all these countries to shape their programs programs and their research in a way that is friendly to what these countries want, explicitly to try to influence U.S. lawmakers to do certain things. I mean, like, that is a part of the way the game has been played, you know, for years. Every major lobbying firm is working for dozens of governments. There are many that also specialize in sort of certain people. But, you know, we never – I mean, you know, where was the big outcry when every major Republican and some Democrats were advocating for the MEK, you know? I mean, they were trying to influence U.S. politics, and that group was on the terrorist list.
Dude, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, when Obama was trying to pass the Iran nuclear deal, came to the U.S., went to Capitol Hill at the invitation of the opposition party, the Republicans, and tried to undermine the sitting president's policy on Iran. I mean, it's just – it's nobody cares about these things because it's okay when our allies do it, I guess. It's okay when all these, like, different interests do it and all these think tanks that are funded by weapons companies and Gulf countries do it. But it's like – with the Russia stuff, it's all about villainizing Russia. And interestingly enough, a lot of these think tanks that are helping to create this climate of anti-Russia hysteria are doing it as a result of the kinds of weapons companies that do fund them. I mean, they're not actually think tanks. They're just covers for weapons companies and Gulf monarchies at the end of the day. And that, like, the Atlantic Council, the Brookings Institution, all of these places are just putting out crap that is like put that actually does influence American policymakers to an extreme degree. That's what's undermining our democracy.
Well, and one issue that I think is crucial here that I know you did some reporting on that I think is also relevant to the stance the Democrats have taken is, you know, in the last campaign, so many of Hillary Clinton's supporters from the sort of neocon community, basically all the neocons, the whole basis was that the problem with Obama was he'd been too soft on Russia and too soft on Iran, that they were going to push forward, that Hillary Clinton was going to push forward this new thing. And I think we often think of quote-unquote neocons as being Republicans, which many of them are in the broad sense, but that to a large degree, they've been trying to sort of nest themselves more and more inside the Democrats because I think they view the Democrats as having the better electoral prospects.
Yeah, but I guess they were really wrong on that. They really didn't call that right. But yeah, no, it's totally true. I mean, that's exactly what was happening throughout the Clinton campaign, especially after she won the primary, was all of these neocons, especially after Trump won the primary, all of these Republican neocons got really scared because they don't think Trump is someone they can easily control. He's unpredictable. And he was saying things like, I want to get rid of NATO. And that freaked them out. And they all went running to the Hillary camp because they fit in there, because there is this sort of convergence. And it's the establishment at the end of the day. It's both the Democratic and the Republican establishment. Obviously, there's some, you know, degrees of difference between them. But at the end of the day, they have similar policy agendas, especially long-term policy agendas, when it comes to foreign policy, because they're all influenced by the same interests, you know? And so that's why they feel so comfortable with people like Hillary Clinton. And so now what you see is those same people, the sort of the neocons having converged with like the neoliberals or whatever, are doing the same thing over Russia. Like, it's like, you know, from the John McCain end of the spectrum to the Democratic end of the spectrum. And it's coming from everywhere. And it's just so disturbing. And it's, I think, you know, I don't know what the neocons are going to do next, but at the same time, they seem to have had the best of both worlds because they're still able to push their policies into the Trump administration. And that's what I kind of see happening now, foreign policy wise, because the Trump administration is, especially on the Middle East, following suit on most of the neocon agenda, except for maybe in Syria, although their Syria policy is still slightly unclear.
I mean, that seems like the true red line in establishment politics in the United States. I mean, McCain called Rand Paul a Russian agent for questioning whether Montenegro should be in NATO. It just seems like they used to say that Social Security was the third rail of U.S. politics, but now it seems like anything to move away from sort of neocon imperialist foreign policy, you touch it, you die.
Well, it's funny. That's the one thing that is so difficult to change. It's like foreign policy is sort of this autonomous creature, or it seems autonomous because there's just massive, powerful interests always pushing it in the same direction, which is towards more endless war, more weapons, company profits, and, you know, just like more towards powerful, like oil, you know, oil company profits. And so it's like difficult to stop that train, but it's really difficult, but it's always easy to speed it up. And I think that's kind of what you're seeing happen now. It's like, it's about to be like on steroids, and you just got you know, especially with the Trump administration. I mean, it's funny to me that neocons are still pushing all these lines. I'm not really sure what it is about Trump that they still hate so much, because to a large degree, except for maybe in Syria, he's moving way to, like, he's pushing their policies. He's pushing, his administration is pushing for confrontation with Iran, for confrontation with China. Like, I mean, his administration is pushing all of these things that they've always, like, have always been, you know, their dream. And so I'm also kind of a little confused as to why, and maybe again, and maybe it's just because he's unpredictable to them, but it's just, it's most, but also it's important to note, it's, this is actually, as much as I hate neocons, this is coming mostly from Democrats. The Democratic Party, this is their strategy against the Republicans, is Republicans try and, you know, get rid of healthcare for people, and Democrats respond by going, hey, Russia, everybody be scared of Russia.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for right now, but I think that is a great place to leave it. That was Rania Kalik, a great journalist. Check out all her work online. We're going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Well, today we are talking about some announcements that took place yesterday regarding the opioid crisis sweeping America from the Trump administration, and we are very happy to be joined by Dr. Kathleen Friedel to continue our conversation. Doctor, thank you so much for joining the show.
My pleasure. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. And good to have you back. It's our pleasure. So, in sort of a weird half announcement here, one, I guess Chris Christie is going to be a high-level advisor to this, I guess, yet-to-be-created and or named Trump panel on the opioid crisis. Does this give you any hope at all that they're taking this issue seriously?
It does. Chris Christie has acquired a tainted national reputation, and he's done a lot to acquire it. But for people who work in the drug reform community, Chris Christie has another side. He is somebody who is very well aware of the opioid crisis and its many facets, you know, first driven by prescription painkillers, later added in heroin and fentanyl. When he ran for re-election a couple of years ago, almost every single town hall he went to, he heard in some way about the drug crisis. And so he has steered through a series of reforms in the state of New Jersey that have had, you know, real credentials backing them. So he has one of the tougher prescription drug monitoring programs in the nation. And just recently, New Jersey joined 9 other states in limiting how and when opioids can be prescribed for the very first time. Mm. So having Chris Christie in charge, I know that got a lot of jeers in the press, but I think among the drug reform community, that's something that, okay, you know, now we're going to pay attention.
Mm. Well, that's certainly very interesting. I'm certainly glad that you said that, because I did not know any of that. I mean, it sort of, which speaks to my sort of second question that I was also wondering, was the form in which it took, which was the form of a commission as well. Because I kind of think whenever you appoint a commission to something, sort of what you're saying is, well, you know, we got to study this and figure out what to do. But I mean, especially based on what you just said about Chris, it seems like we have a pretty good idea, people who really want to solve this crisis, what to do. And it makes me fear that perhaps a commission will be, you know, to put out a report and then we'll never hear anything else about it again.
Yeah, I have that fear too. And I also have additional fears about the nature of this commission. We can talk more about it. But I think that first and foremost, what it does is it signals to the American people, and in particular to Trump voters, that the White House is taking this problem very, very seriously. And in that sense, I have to tell you, Eugene, I view the formation of a White House Blue Ribbon Commission on the opioid crisis to be long overdue. Mm. I'm surprised Obama didn't do it. This is the worst drug crisis in U.S. history. And so the first thing that Trump is conveying by putting together this commission is, you know, he's trying to say or just perform how important that this is to, you know, the American people and his voters. Having said that, Trump has this uncanny knack of naming what were heretofore unnamed problems within the political establishment and then proposing as solutions the very thing driving the problem in the first place. And, you know, I shouldn't laugh about that because there's nothing funny about it. So, you know, I think that I'm in a small group of people who don't automatically view this commission as disqualifying or tainted just because it has Chris Christie and so on and so forth. But I am, let's say, reserving judgment and waiting to see what they do. You know, I think that there are two, like, the biggest concern one could have is, will this commission recommend a militant approach, like a drug war type approach for interdicting heroin, or will it be biased in favor and treatment? So that's like one of the first kind of questions one can pose, because Chris Christie is chairing it, but, you know, Jeff Sessions is on it, you know?
Right. I mean, and Jeff Sessions, who's just making things up about the opioid crisis as he goes, it seems.
Absolutely, and he's not alone. John Kelly, who got just a total pass-through by Democrats in the Congress, and I don't know why, because John Kelly feels like he can attribute, he can call opioid overdose deaths narco-terrorism. I mean, he did that in his confirmation hearing. That's a very scary thing to do, because there are all kinds of government apparatus that apply to narco-terrorism that don't apply to American communities, or shouldn't. So, I mean, that was alarming to me, and it just didn't attract a lot of attention. So that's one of the basic questions. And I think you can sort of drill down and come up with other questions, like, will this commission, which is ostensibly about drug addiction in general, will it be circumscribed to only basically white people and prescription painkillers, or will it take a more holistic approach? You know what I'm saying? There are all kinds of questions nested within the original question of, like, well, will it be militant versus treatment and stuff? But what you said is striking to me about, you know, it seems like we have a good idea of the path forward, because one of the questions, you know, that if you drill down into the commission that I have, is a lot of the most obvious steps that you are right to refer to as obvious are almost politically impossible right now in Washington, D.C., right? My friend Joe Sudbe likes to say Washington, D.C. is the place where the obvious is hard. So we should be limiting prescription painkillers, and we should be doing it on a national basis. We should also have a national prescription drug monitoring program. But all of these things would require confronting the powers that be, and in particular confronting Big Pharma. So I'm very interested to see if this commission will do that.
Well, and I'm glad you raised that point, because I think that's a big piece. And I'm curious what you think about this lawsuit from Everett Washington, for people who don't know, it's just right by Seattle, against Purdue Pharmaceuticals, which has been allowed to proceed. I mean, it seems like the discovery in that case and the way that is could perhaps give us one of the best looks we've had yet at how Big Pharma is really involved in this.
So we've had several looks, and a lot of the looks that we want to have still remain under seal in court documents. So what you just referred to is a very important lawsuit going forward, based on reporting from the Los Angeles Times that Purdue Pharma had in its hand information that would have assisted the Drug Enforcement Administration in its investigation of wholesale drug distributors that were inundating certain communities and certain physicians and pharmacies with opioid painkillers. And this is information that the DEA said in the LA Times article, we would have loved to have had our hands on this information, but Purdue Pharma never saw fit to pass it over. Well, Everett was one of the places named as having, you know, information that would have assisted, or been the target of information that would have assisted the DEA. And so they filed suit. And you're right, that suit is just allowed to go forward. There have been other things, like lawsuits by individual states like West Virginia and Kentucky. The Kentucky lawsuit still remains under seal. Stat News has filed to have that information released. That court case is proceeding at great expense to Stat News, which is this kind of news site that's devoted to healthcare issues. It's online. It's done some of the best reporting on the opioid crisis that I know about. So we have all various looks. Probably, Eugene, the best look we could have at Purdue Pharma and other shady practices from other large companies in this space is the Senate 2012 investigation into these practices, which has not been made public.
Wow.
Yes, despite many of us asking and, you know, just wondering why. And Claire McCaskill, to great fanfare, just announced that she's going to investigate five major dealers, the five major pharma companies, in this space since 2012. Well, why since 2012? Because she already has a Senate investigation that took place prior to that, but nobody's making it public, right? Nobody's making that information public. So we could have at our fingertips a much better look, as you described it, at all kinds of things that Big Pharma has been up to since opioid prescription pain and kill prescribing has quadrupled in this country. We could know, but because of the powers that be are disposed in favor of pharma, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great point. And it leads me to sort of one of my next things that I learned while researching the Everett lawsuit that I did not know, that I guess Purdue Pharma has already had to pay a fine in the state of Washington for deceptive advertising when they were talking about prescription painkillers to doctors. And it made me wonder, you know, how should we evaluate the role of sort of the medical profession itself?
Yes.
I mean, is it just like a handful of bad doctors, or is it just this sort of incentive structure for how new drugs get promoted?
It's both. And you know what is so interesting, Eugene, is that a lot of my understanding of this issue derives from my understanding, my historical understanding of policing as an institution. Do you know how law enforcement always tries to make like it's a couple of bad apples?
Right.
And you know what I'm saying? And in fact, there are bad apples. I'm not going to lie. I mean, there are bad apples in law enforcement, right? But there are also pervasive features of the institutional culture and incentives in place that make it so. And you know what I mean? So it's not just the bad apples. So what you're describing, yes, we have had pain mills, painkiller mills prescribing and hugely over-prescribing prescription narcotics. But for the medical profession to pretend that this is strictly, you know, down to a few bad actors is obscene. Mm-hmm. And it's questionably, I mean, I don't put this out there as fact, but one could argue it's sort of a pervasive profession-wide violation of the Hippocratic Oath. We still have broad prescribing for opioid painkillers for chronic pain, even though there's not one single meta-analysis that have shown its effectiveness. Mm. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the patent structure in this country and how it facilitates certain business predatory practices. I mean, there are all kinds of things, and it's not just the medical profession. I think you're right to name it, Eugene, but we could also be talking about other people who are supposed to safeguard our interests, namely the Food and Drug Administration.
That's actually a very good question. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of sort of missing in action elements here to people who you would expect. Obviously, I think that you hit the nail on the head there with the, if I'm not mistaken about this, Big Pharma spends the most money, I think, of any industry in donations and lobbying and all of that. I could be wrong about that, but I believe I saw that. But it just finds a way to fly under the radar in ways that perhaps Wall Street doesn't. But let me also ask you this. You know, how do you evaluate Joe Manchin's performance here? I mean, you know, to some degree, West Virginia is ground zero in all this. Stat News, which you already mentioned, had an amazing report about how the people who make OxyContin, like, went so far above and beyond the call of duty to just flood the place with pills. And then you get Joe Manchin coming on TV talking about, like, you know, weed being a gateway drug or whatever. I don't know. I mean, it's shocking to me.
It should be shocking. West Virginia is right now in the process of passing a medical marijuana bill. It passed the House and it's moving over to the Senate. And one of the questions I have about that bill as it moves forward is, does it have the blessing of, you know, Senator Joe Manchin? He has come out. And by the way, this is probably known to you, but may not be known to all of your listeners, that his daughter is a lobbyist for pharma. Right. And was implicated in the price hike, the opportunistic price hike on the EpiPen. Right. So his hands are by no means clean. I think it's not just his opposition to marijuana that is worth underscoring as a concern. It is also that when he is asked about the opioid crisis, he always names Mexican cartels, you know, trafficking in heroin and never, ever names those drug traffickers that come to his state in suits and with briefcases. West Virginia has suffered at the hands of both of those people.
You know, Paul LePage, same thing here. I mean, it maybe is a window into just how much, and I'm curious your thoughts about this, because there's been certainly some criticisms coming out of the black community that this crisis is being taken more seriously and treated more softly than the crack epidemic because of who has been affected by it. And it seems that, you know, I'm curious your thoughts on that. But it seems like, in addition to what you're also saying about how it's like it's always the cartels, that this sort of racialized image of the drug trade is so powerful and so embedded in our society.
And that racialized image, just to pick up on your last point first, that racialized image does a lot of work to stigmatize addiction itself, right? And so people should be extremely guarded with that kind of rhetoric. So, of course, I understand and fully align myself with the critique coming from a lot of different, not just different kind of thought leaders in the Black community, but just communities themselves saying, like, you know, where was all of this attention during the crack epidemic? And I have two things to say about it. One is we can't even separate the first heroin epidemic, the one that prompted President Nixon to declare war against heroin and launch essentially what people think of as the drug war. We can't even separate that story, let alone the crack story, from the story of the deindustrialization of the urban north, the disappearance of work, and all the kind of depredations that were visited on these communities. And I think that that's a useful way to think about the opioid crisis and how the disappearance of work has affected rural and non-metro communities, basically since NAFTA, right? So a lot of the features of these stories are similar, and we should be talking about them together, right? I mean, the sort of the case for understanding them is strengthened when we consider them in conjunction. Having said that, there are ways in which the crack epidemic, it's worse, it visited its worst harms because of the homicide rates that accompanied it, right? So you could have in the early 1990s cities with predominantly Black populations, not just majority, but predominantly Black populations, have homicide rates that were like 100 or 115 per 100,000 people. That's obscene. Those are obscene levels of homicide rates. That's a wrecking ball being visited upon our urban communities, right? We are now seeing that level of death, so 115, 120 per 100,000, with just drug overdoses in the opioid epidemic. Okay. I mean, that's where we are with the opioid epidemic. And it's far more pervasive in the sense that it's just affected and killed a lot more people. And that's why we talk about it as the worst drug crisis in U.S. history. It's just killing more people.
You know, I'm curious about this last 2 minutes here, but I also want your thoughts on this. Insurance companies, what's their role? Because I had read some article, and I'm not sure the veracity of it, that one issue here in terms of the prescription of these drugs is that a lot of the sort of therapeutic techniques that could be used to deal with chronic pain, they take longer, they cost more money, and those people can't afford them.
Yes, that article is not wrong. Sam Quinones in his book Dreamland, which I recommend to all your listeners, picks up on this as well. And there are some doctors I know who have published in medical journals. They call this the pharmaceuticalization of pain. And what they mean by that is the idea of prescribing opioid painkillers to more people than we ever have before to treat chronic pain coincided with managed care in the late 1990s. And what they're trying to draw attention to is the way in which insurance companies would rather just write a check for a prescription than handle a tailored diagnosis, you know, for you or for me that might involve acupuncture. It might involve a social worker. It might involve, you know, kind of adjusting my job so that it doesn't exacerbate my chronic pain, so on and so forth. Now, those things are less expensive to the entire system in the sense that over the long term they pay off. But in the immediate transaction sense, the insurance company would just rather write the check for the opioid.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. And that's Dr. Kathleen Friedel. She's an author, political historian. She's also written on Social Security. So check all of her work out if you can. That is going to do it for our time here on today's show. You were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Pergier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.